106.
I'm Marty Moscow-Wayne. Welcome to Radio Times. A recent survey by the Atlantic Council found that Americans' view of Cuba is changing. A majority favor normalizing relations with that country that has been under a trade embargo for more than 50 years. Life is changing in Cuba, too, most notably with the rise of small businesses. While President Obama has eased some of the travel restrictions for Cuban Americans, it's up to Congress if the embargo is going to be lifted or not. It's hard to imagine finding majority support for what has been such a long-standing contentious issue. Nonetheless, the survey raises some intriguing questions about the relationship between Cuba and the United States, our topic for this hour of Radio Times. We have two guests who have joined us. Peter Schechter joining us from Washington, D.C. He's the first director of the Atlantic Council's Adrian Arsht Latin America Center. Peter Schechter, nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
Marty, thanks for inviting me.
You're welcome. And joining us from Lima, Peru, is Michael Reed. He writes the Bello column on Latin America for The Economist. He's also the newspaper's writer-at-large for the region. And Michael Reed, nice to have you with us on Radio Times as well.
Good morning. Very good to be with you.
Nice to have you both with us. Peter, let me begin with you and begin with this survey and the overall takeaway. What were some of the reasons that this majority of Americans told you for wanting to normalize relations with Cuba?
Well, the survey had a number of interesting findings. First of all, I think let me just take a second and give you the overall picture. 56% of Americans favor normalization with Cuba, and 35 want to keep the policy the way it is. And what was interesting about that was that when we asked, when we sort of sliced and diced what the embargo meant, in other words, the travel restrictions, the financial restrictions, Cuba on the terrorism list. And so we asked people about those specific issues, and on each of those, the numbers were even higher, 62% of Americans favor taking away the travel ban. 61% of the Americans favor removing Cuba from the terrorism list. So that was the first interesting finding. And the second one was that on all of those categories, Florida and Hispanics actually feel more strongly about the need to normalize relations than the rest of the United States. In each of those categories where the United States wants, 56% of Americans want to normalize relations, actually 62% of Floridians want to normalize relations, and 63% of Hispanics. So it was interesting that actually Florida, which has always been seen as this, as Cuba is the poison chalice of Florida politics, actually it turns out that it's not. Floridians are ahead of the United States in wanting to begin a process of normalization with Cuba.
And is that because they have family and friends who still live in Cuba?
Well, I think the Cuban Americans are not the majority in Florida. I think there is a sense in Florida, because it is closest in a way. One thing this poll found is that the closer you are to this issue, and nobody is closer than Floridians and Hispanics, the more you want the issue to be resolved. And I think Florida is a combination of being close. I mean, we're talking about a neighbor of Florida's, 90 miles off the coast. So Floridians also are the majority of flights to Cuba go through Florida. Floridians probably understand the economic issues. And then I think the Cuban American community has, you know, after there are, you know, we're now in the third or fourth generation of Cuban American exiles, and I think people believe that it's time to solve the problem.
Michael Reed, let me go to you down in Lima, Peru. You have covered Cuba and its relationship with many of its neighbors. Is there anything in this survey that surprises you?
No, I think for a long time. I mean, Cuba itself is an anachronism. American policy towards Cuba has been, in many ways, an even greater anachronism. And it's been sustained by the rather powerful political leadership of the first generation of Cuban exiles in Florida and their children. But as Peter says, as the generations go past, more and more people in Florida, as in the rest of the country, think it's very odd that the U.S. should not have normal relations with a country so geographically close to it. After all, in the last 30 to 40 years, the United States has achieved or entered into normal relations with communist China, normal relations even with Vietnam, despite the war. So it's more and more a complete aberration that it should not have ordinary relations with Cuba, which doesn't mean that they have to be great friends. It just means recognizing that the embargo has failed and that the rest of the world has long since recognized that the right thing to do is to trade on normal business terms with Cuba.
And Peter Schechter, is one of the reasons for wanting to begin to normalize relations is, as Michael Reed just said, the embargo has failed. I mean, it didn't get rid of the Castro regime.
Well, Michael is one of the wisest observers of Latin America, and he called this an anachronism, and I think that's what it is. But it's, you know, in a way, it's even more than that. In the way, it's this unbelievable man bites dog story, because here you have a superpower that for 55 years has had a policy to try to create regime change in Cuba. So supposedly we're the ones trying to isolate the Cubans. And if you look at what Cuba is today, I mean, the EU has just announced a major policy change towards Cuba, and they're going to go into a very important increase in trade and relations with the island of Cuba. The Latin American presidents last month had a meeting in which all Latin American presidents, including our best friends in Latin America, Mexico and Colombia and Chile, all presidents went to Cuba for this summit, which excluded the United States and Canada. So we have a policy of regime change and of isolating the Cubans, but suddenly what we find actually is that we're the ones that are isolated because of our policy. So it really is a policy that is screaming for a review.
Michael Reed, let me go back to you and get, I guess, you're going to be the stand-in for the Cuban perspective. But would you say the Cuban people, even the Cuban government, wants less restrictions between that country and ours?
Well, that's a very good question, and I'm sure the Cuban people certainly would want that. Whether the government really wants it deep down, I don't know, because of course it says that the embargo should end and so on, and that they want good relations with the United States. But as Peter was alluding to, the extraordinary thing about the American embargo is that it's been utterly counterproductive, because it's provided the best propaganda tool for the regime in Havana, and it's allowed them to blame the shortcomings of Cuba's communist economy on the enemy. Raul Castro has been in charge in Havana for the last 5 years or so, has been much more honest than Fidel, than his elder brother, in saying that Cuba's economic problems are of its own making. Nevertheless, the embargo has been an important propaganda tool. I think whether the government would really like it to end and policy to change, I'm sure there are different views within Havana about that, because there is this process of reform from the top going on in Cuba towards a more capitalist economy. It's still very limited. It's still very slow. But at some point, for that to work and for that to gain momentum, normal relations with the United States would be enormously helpful. The question is whether or not that point has been reached, because Raul Castro, who's pushing forward this reform program, faces enormous resistance from within the Communist Party bureaucracy, because he faces the classic dilemma of reformers, that you tend to create losers before you create winners. And that's the situation he finds himself in now.
Peter, let me go back to you and actually going back to the survey, because when you ask or you make a statement and then ask a question, the statement about Cuba, statement number 4, reads like this: Cuba continues to have a dismal human rights record. The Castro regime represses virtually all forms of political dissent through detentions, arbitrary arrests, beatings, travel restrictions, forced exile, and sentencing dissidents in closed trials. When you frame the question that way, you really get a different response, where you find that most people want to keep the embargo and fewer people want to engage or normalize relations.
So we asked a number of questions to test messages. So, and we wanted to test messages from both sides. We wanted to have we wanted to simulate the debate that actually goes on about Cuba and that would go on would the president or the Congress decide to do anything to change it. So we actually gave people 3 really persuasive questions that would stimulate people to want to say, you know, these are really all the good reasons for wanting to normalize relations with Cuba. And then we gave people 3 really tough questions about here are some of the best reasons for not wanting to normalize, and would that make you feel more like wanting to change policy or less? We didn't ask if these questions really, in essence, you know, if this changed your mind, but we asked, are these persuasive messages? And, you know, look, you know, Cuba is as repressive, as abusive, and as undemocratic a regime as it has been over, you know, when it began 55 years ago. I mean, this is a country that is an absolute dictatorship that allows and provides no ability for free press, no ability for a real free debate of ideas. There are, as Michael said, there is certainly a new economic breeze flowing through Cuba, in which there are small businesses that are now being allowed to make money on their own. There are some NGOs being tolerated, but essentially this is a dictatorship. And I think, you know, people, we asked at the end of the poll, so once we simulated this debate, you know, pros and cons, we asked at the end of the poll the same question that we asked at the beginning of the poll, which was, are you in favor of normalizing relations with Cuba? And essentially, there was no change. We went down, the favorable numbers went from 56 to 55, which is within the margin of error. So, you know, essentially, there was no change after everybody heard all the pros and all the cons. So, you know, I think essentially what Americans, you know, what I read in that is that Americans are essentially believe, look, I mean, we had a policy in which we wanted to change the government of a country whose people are abused and who have no liberties or rights. 55 years later, the same government is there, and the people continue to have no liberties and no rights. So perhaps we need to look at a couple of different options.
Well, we're going to take a very short break and then get back to our conversation. Put the same question to our listeners: should the United States normalize relations with Cuba? Give us a call at 1-888-477-9499. Send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org, and you can send us a tweet at WHYY Radio Times. We will continue with our 2 guests after this very short break. Stay with us. We'll be right back.
Support for WHYY comes from Delaware Valley College. Delaware Valley College offers a Master of Arts in Counseling Psychology that prepares culturally competent practitioners to work in the mental health field. Students can choose from social justice community counseling or child and adolescent counseling. More information about a Master's of Arts in Counseling Psychology from Delaware Valley College is available online at delval.edu/grad.
Steve, let me ask you something. When you're hosting NPR's Morning Edition, how do you keep all those news stories straight in your head?
By listening. I don't pretend to know all the answers. My job is to know who to ask and how to ask them. At NPR's Morning Program, our job is to push for real stories, honest answers.
And you can listen with us on Morning Edition from NPR News.
Weekday mornings on WHYY.
I'm Robin Young. Next time on Here and Now, legendary guitarist Pat Metheny on his new CD, Kin, and his kinship with saxophonist Chris Potter. next time on Here and Now from NPR and WBUR Boston.
This afternoon at 1 on WHYY.
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscoe, talking with Michael Reed. He writes the Bellow column on Latin America for The Economist. He's the newspaper's writer-at-large for the region. Joining us from Lima, Peru, he's written a number of books, including one coming out this year called Brazil, The Troubled Rise of a Global Power. Also with us, Peter Schechter. He's the director of the Atlantic Council's Adrian Arsht Latin America Center, and the Atlantic Council just released a survey about the United States relationship with Cuba. He's affiliated with Ben-Gurion University, also the George Washington University. And we have a couple open lines at 1-888-477-9499. Michael Reed, if I can go back to you, if there were not remittances coming from the United States to Cuba, how would Cuba's economy, what would it look like? How would it be faring?
Well, I think you have to bear in mind that the remittances from the United States actually go to this incipient private sector in Cuba. They to people who are setting up small businesses, restaurants or guest houses or a series of small kind of repair firms and things like that. They're not going to the government. And if you took those remittances away, I think you'd weaken that incipient private sector instead of strengthening it. I mean, the big picture here, as Peter mentioned, is that you've had this policy which for 50 years was based on the notion that if you strangle the Cuban economy, you will create the conditions for internal dissidents to rise up and the population to rise up to support them to overthrow the regime. And that's a fantasy. It simply hasn't happened, even in the worst of times in Cuba. And that's partly because it's an island. It's partly because there's a degree of popular support still for the regime. So the big question is, how do you help change to come about in Cuba? Because, as Peter said, one should have no illusions. Cuba is a dictatorship still. There is not a process of political reform going on. But the notion that you can bring about political reform by strangling the economy has been tried for 50 years and failed. So what many people in Latin America think, and now in Europe, is that a policy which is aimed at supporting the growth of a private sector in Cuba will, in the medium term, have more chance of succeeding in bringing about a broader liberalization. But one should have no illusions. It's going to take time.
Well, Peter, and this is more of a political question having to do with either the White House or even Congress, is there any appetite for taking on this issue, knowing that even if a majority of people support normalization, the opponents or the critics, this is their issue, and they will wage a loud campaign against it?
They certainly will. To answer that question, let me just go back to something critical which Michael said that I don't want left untalked about, which is there are no real differences. There's one real difference between those who favor normalization and those who favor keeping this policy. And the debate centers not around the fundamentals, which is we all want to bring change to Cuba. As Michael said, this is a dictatorial government in which there has been some economic reforms, but no political reforms. And so everybody wants to bring change to Cuba. The only question is how to best do it. So the debate is really not around the fundamental objective, but it's around methods. And so,
part of that, the question would be then, if the embargo didn't work, would lifting the embargo bring about some of these political reforms?
So, well, I think that it would. There is no doubt in my mind, and I think Michael would agree with me, that to a large extent, this has been the Castro government's crutch for 50 years. I mean, you have a country here that has been completely repressed. It is 30, maybe even 40 years behind the rest of Latin America in terms of economic development. I mean, you travel to Cuba, and everybody always tells you that it's like time travel. You deal with cars that are 30 years old. You deal with an infrastructure that's 30 years old. I mean, bar education and health, which have made real progress in Cuba, the economy is very, very, very behind the rest of the region. And so how has that government survived? It survived by using the crutch of saying that we are under siege. You know, they use the word in Spanish, el bloqueo, the blockade. Mm-hmm. This is their favorite word. You know, you arrive in Cuba and there's a huge sign that says, you know, we stand firm against the blockade. I mean, this is what they've used as a crutch to be able to make an excuse for having an ungovernment. You know, so I think, you know, how is it possible to change this here in the United States? I think the political debate of having Congress remove the embargo, I mean, Congress can't agree on whether it's night or day, so the possibility of having them remove the embargo is nil. They're not going to even debate it. So the question is, what can the president do by executive order to reduce the embargo's effect? You need to think of the embargo as a volume button on your stereo. Only Congress can remove the volume button,
right,
but the president gets to lower and higher the knob between 1 and 10.
So that would be, I know from your survey, there's support for a special envoy to Cuba, perhaps even lifting some of the restrictions to allow a certain level of trade to go through, Peter?
That's right. You can do a certain level of trade. You can also facilitate travel to Cuba by lifting a lot of the restrictions that you need to apply for a travel license. You know, Cuba is on a terrorism list along with countries such as Syria and Iran. You know, I got to ask you whether Cuba represents a real terrorism threat similar to the ones that Syria or Iran represent. So there are a number of options that the administration might want to consider that would be able to at least permit the United States to say, look, we no longer have an embargo on Cuba. And I think that's the important policy point. We need to take away the crutch that the Castro government has been using for 55 years.
Let me get Peggy from Elkins Park to join our conversation. She's a local tour operator. And Peggy, go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Hi, thanks for taking my call.
You're welcome. Go ahead.
We in the past 2.5 years have had one of those people-to-people licenses, and we've taken quite a few thousands of people to Cuba on our programs. Early last winter, we did our own survey among returning travelers to find out how they felt about the experience of going to Cuba and specifically how they felt about issues like the embargo. And our results definitely, while our survey was much smaller, it definitely mirrors the survey that you're discussing today. We also discovered that the Americans who are coming to Cuba are in a big way supporting this nascent entrepreneurial openness that's been allowed now in Cuba, and they are really the ones that are supporting many of these new businesses, the small restaurants, the paladars, the artists, people like that. And the travelers who are returning are very much supportive of lifting the embargo. They're very much supportive of better relations with Cuba. And as a side note, the Cubans are getting to learn a lot about us as people because there's a lot of direct interaction, and they're starting to discover that we are actually very nice and decent and friendly and honest people because they're getting to meet way more Americans than just their cousins from Florida.
I hear you.
To meet people from Iowa and Minnesota and all over the United States.
Well, Peggy, let me take your point because I think it's an interesting one. And Michael Reed, I want to toss it to you about we've been talking about, you know, political relationship and diplomacy. Peggy is talking about, you know, the people-to-people contact and how that might be changing the relationship.
Yeah, I mean, I think that it's useful for Americans to learn more about Cuba, and it's obviously useful for ordinary Cubans to learn more about Americans. But I do think that you know, the process of change in Cuba is going to come from principally from within, and there's a couple of other factors that I think we haven't mentioned yet that are important to mention. The first is that Raúl Castro is in his second presidential term. He has said that he will not go for a third term. So in 2018, in 4 years' time, he will stand down. And, you know, the Castros are in very much in the twilight of their lives and their careers. And Raúl is extremely conscious that there will be a generational change in the leadership in Cuba. And whoever succeeds him, and it'll probably be his vice president, who's a much younger man who wasn't involved in the 1959 revolution, whoever succeeds him will be judged by the Cuban people strictly on results. There won't be any of the kind of the revolutionary halo around them. Right? The second big factor is that for the past 10 years, the Cuban economy has received significant aid from Venezuela, from Hugo Chavez, and now from Nicolas Maduro. The situation in Venezuela is obviously uncertain, at least in the medium term, and Raúl Castro knows that. So there are imperatives, very powerful internal imperatives for this driving this reform process, slow and difficult though it is. And it's for those reasons that one thinks that that Cuba in 5 to 10 years' time is going to be a very different place than it is today. And I'm sure there'll be many more American tourists like the ones that your caller is taking to the island.
Well, I would assume tourists that want to go to Cuba are probably interested in normalizing relations with that country. Peggy, thanks for the call to Radio Times. Peter, if I can go back to you and ask you about Alan Gross, because I know that's an important issue when we talk about Cuba. What can you tell us?
Well, Alan Gross was a worker for the United States Agency for International Development, and he was in Cuba on assignment, working for as a contractor for the U.S. government. When he was unjustly arrested, and you know, I think there isn't a single person, no matter on which side of the argument you are, that believes that Alan Gross is arrested and imprisoned and sent to, I think it's 13 or 15 years in prison, that there isn't anybody who thinks that there is a shred of fairness or justice in that sentencing. You know, he is now, unfortunately, as the only U.S. citizen in Cuban jail, he is you know, a principal pawn, unfortunately, because he's also ill, in this political game between the Castros and the United States government. And the real question, it's a very good example because of what Michael was talking about when he said he wasn't so sure that the Cuban government really wants a detente with the United States, because there is one really clear way to get it. Because if they would release Alan Gross, it would be the clearest, loudest, starkest signal that there really is interest in Cuba in trying to change a policy with the United States. It would be nobody has to invent some new step. The release of Alan Gross would be the real way to do this, and they haven't done it.
Michael Reed, let me go back to you, and you had talked about the relationship between Cuba and Venezuela. You have written, or The Economist has written, about the relationship between Cuba and North Korea. How should we understand that? And how does that figure into our conversation?
Yeah, I mean, I think, there was this incident, bizarre incident last year, in which a North Korean freighter was detained in Panama, and it was discovered that there were parts of MiG fighter jets from Cuba going to North Korea. It seems that this was an attempt by the Cuban armed forces to make some money. Cuba has relations with North Korea, and you know the North Korean regime is obviously even more unpleasant than the Cuban regime. But I don't think anybody seriously thinks that Cuba is the kind of security, it poses the kind of security threat to its neighbors that North Korea clearly does to its neighbors. Those relations are a function of the fact that it's one of the few remaining communist regimes in the world. And to an extent, it's true, I think, that if the U.S. tries to make it difficult for Cuba to have more normal relations with democratic countries, then, it ends up with these kinds of relations. Mm. But that's not an excuse. I don't think the friendship with North Korea is, extremely close, but it's there for Cuba. And that's something else that I think Cuban foreign policy is also evolving in a more pragmatic direction. Its relations with the rest of Latin America are ever more important for it. Remember that it's only 20 years or so that since Cuba was an integral part of the communist economic bloc, things have changed quite a lot, but change with Cuba is always slow.
Peter Schichter, let me go back to you, and I'm curious about if the U.S. were to normalize relations with Cuba, would that change how the United States is viewed in that neighborhood, in South America, in Latin America?
That's a great question. I have come around to believe that the Cuba issue has grown to be this boulder-sized pebble in the shoe of the relations between the United States and Latin America. I mean, it is every one of our closest Latin American friends talks about it to President Obama and to previous presidents when they come here or when they meet. President Santos of Colombia, probably the closest U.S. ally in the region, an amazing and exciting turnaround story of a country that 20 years ago, whose name was connected to drug cartels, and today the name is connected to a miracle turnaround. I mean, Medellin, the drug cartel city, was named by the Wall Street Journal last year as the most innovative city in the world, beating out Tel Aviv and Sydney. And so President Santos talked to President Obama about the issue of Cuba. When President Obama visited the Mexican president, another one of our closest allies, just recently in a summit between Mexico and Canada and the United States, President Peña Nieto also mentioned this to President Obama. I mean, there's a real sense that it is incumbent upon the United States to clear the decks. It becomes very difficult to defend the United States when there is this very arbitrary policy that America has with Cuba that it doesn't have with other countries that are equally dictatorial and unpleasant.
We have to take a very short break, and we'll get back to our conversation talking about Cuba-U.S. relations. Stay with us. We'll be right back.
Supporting WHYY, the Philadelphia Museum of Art, presenting Treasures from Korea, Arts and Culture of the Joseon Dynasty, the first full-scale American exhibition devoted to the art of the Joseon Dynasty. 500 years of tradition, ritual, and honor from a line of 27 kings that shaped contemporary Korea. The exhibition brings many Korean national treasures to the U.S. for the first time. On view through May 26th. Tickets and info at philamuseum.org.
Peter Lanza, the father of Adam Lanza, the Sandy Hook killer, broke his media silence in a series of interviews with Andrew Solomon. On the next Fresh Air, we talk with Solomon about what Peter Lanza told him, including that he wishes his son had never been born. Solomon's article about the Lanza family is in the current edition of The New Yorker. Join us. This afternoon at 3 and again tonight at 7 on WHYY.
eternal youth or eternal adolescence?
The generation gap is closing. I think that stems from a larger cultural obsession with youth, the desire that people have to stay young. I don't necessarily think that's super productive.
Teenage culture grew out of an expectation of living longer. Where does youth end and adulthood begin in our time? That's next time on The Takeaway from PRI, Public Radio International.
Today at noon on WHYY.
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscowen. Producer Susan Greenbaum's husband, Marvin Greenbaum, was recently in Cuba. We have put some of his gorgeous photographs on our homepage. Check them out at whyy.org/Radio Times. And join our conversation talking with Peter Schechter from the Atlantic Council, Michael Reed from The Economist, talking about the relationship between Cuba and the United States. We're taking calls at 1-888-477-9499. Send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org, and you can send us a tweet at WHYY Radio Times. Let me get Tim from Pennington, New Jersey to join our conversation. And Tim, go ahead. You're on the air.
Hi, Marty.
Hi there.
Love the show.
Thank you.
So I'm a little disturbed by the way that we've just pushed out the idea that the embargo has negatively affected the Cuban economy at all. With that in mind, I was wondering what our goals as Americans in thinking about ending the embargo or turning down the embargo should be. Should we be thinking about helping Cuban people, protecting Cuban sovereignty, the state, or removing the Castros, or recreating some kind of tourist hotspot like it was in the 50s? I guess I was just wanted to know what our goals should be as Americans.
Let me ask you, you don't think the embargo has hurt Cuba? Is that what you're saying, Tim?
No, I am saying that I think the embargo has hurt the Cuban economy tremendously, and the idea that it's just sort of a crutch for the Cuban government might be a little bit of an oversimplification in my mind.
Okay, fair enough. Now, I appreciate the call to Radio Times. He does raise a question about it, you know, if this relationship doesn't serve either Cuba or the United States, what kind of relationship should we have with this country? Michael Reed, I'm going to send that down to you in Lima, Peru.
Well, I would say two things. I mean, firstly, yes, it's true that the embargo does impose economic costs on Cuba. It makes foreign trade in general more difficult in some ways for Cuba because foreign shipping that has called at a Cuban port cannot call immediately afterwards at a U.S. port, for example. But it's also true that the Cuban economy, Cuba's communist economy, is actually, you know, pretty bad at producing anything very useful. So I mean, the underperformance of the Cuban economy has been, you know, self-inflicted. But your caller Tim, I think his name was, raises an important point, which is, you know, what should be the aim of U.S. policy towards Cuba? And, you know, I think it should be I think there are two things. Firstly, I think in general, you should only apply sanctions in very exceptional circumstances as a foreign policy principle. It's usually better to have normal relations, which doesn't mean, you know, bear-hugging friendships, but it means normal relations. But what should be the aim of U.S. policy? Mm-hmm. I think it should be to do what it can to support a process of peaceful change in Cuba and peaceful evolution towards a market economy and a democracy. One should be under no illusion that, you know, firstly, that process, as I said before, will have to come from within the main driver for it, and secondly, that it will take time. But that should be the end of the policy. And it's simply, you know, the current policy is simply not working in that direction, quite the contrary. So I think, you know, that's why it needs to change. I mean, the other thing that one might add is that, you know, nobody else in the world supports it, the U.S. policy. And so the idea that you ever could have
organized a global embargo against Cuba is just a fantasy, isn't it?
Well, but Peter, and taking sort of reading into some of what Tim's question saying, you know, would it just be turning it into a tourist mecca of the 1950s? The idea, I guess, of Cuba as a kind of a playground for rich Americans. Is there a danger that even if this embargo were lifted, that it wouldn't necessarily benefit Cuba?
Well, I hope not. I mean, I think Michael really defined really super well what the policy should be to really try to foment and help the process of change to occur on the island. I mean, if you really think about it, Cuba is the last remaining place in the Western Hemisphere where people aren't free. You know, we have all types of different governments in the hemisphere, some of them far better than others. I mean, certainly in Venezuela, there's a strange mixture of, you know, the government is democratically elected, but there's now a repression. But nowhere is there a real dictatorship like Cuba. And so I think that should be the policy. I don't think that we are where we were in the late 40s and 1950s, where, the mafia is building casinos in the Caribbean and luring tourists down there. I think that the world has changed, and that's no longer where we're going to be. I think can ask a really good question, which is, you know, what should our policy be? And hopefully, will we be able to work together with a country that is, you know, it's a small country with 11 million people, about the size of Honduras, about the size of Austria in terms of population, and, you know, can we begin to work together as partners and, importantly, as neighbors? There are a lot of people who are concerned about things like oil spills in the Gulf of Mexico, which would directly affect both countries. And so there are the beginnings of actually working together on environmental mitigation issues, drug trafficking issues, and things like that, which I think are important when you are living next to a country that's just 90 miles off your coast.
Let me get Jack from Newcastle, Delaware, to join our conversation. Hi, Jack. Go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Yes, I think it would be interesting to know how we finally got to this policy, because prior to this, it was never a big issue with most Americans, but it goes back to Bill Clinton, running for president for the first time. He was in the Florida primary, and he's running out of funds. And the immigrants that came from Cuba were largely sort of the wealthier class, the middle class, upper middle class professionals, and they were a source of a great deal of funding for him, helping him out at a very critical time. And when Clinton became president, he sort of made this the official policy and funding he received, which helped him in the election. So there's a lot of politics to get back to the simple issue right there.
Well, I think it precedes Clinton, but let me see what Peter Schechter has to say. Peter, is it all Bill Clinton's fault?
I don't know if it's all Bill Clinton's fault. I mean, this is a policy that has preceded Bill Clinton, that has went through Bill Clinton, and, you know, it's been a policy of both Democratic and Republican administrations. There really hasn't been a lot of change. I mean, the Obama administration has made perhaps one of the more important changes, which is the change in which it has allowed Americans of Cuban descent to travel freely to the island. It's a strange policy because only one type of ethnic class of Americans is allowed to go to the island without a specific permission from the government. But let me go back to an interesting point that the caller made about Florida. I mean, there is a very interesting experiment going on in Florida right now, because the governor's race is basically now between the present governor, who's a Republican, and the former governor, who was a Republican, has become a Democrat, and just in the last few weeks has come out for normalization. So this will be the first time that there has been in 40 years any major political candidate for running for statewide office in Florida that is in favor of normalization. So I think that this is going to be, more than the poll that we did, more than anything that anybody says, that election is going to be a watershed about the issue of normalization. I'm not at all saying that that the election is going to be only about Cuba, but if Charlie Crist actually wins the election, notwithstanding what he said about Cuba, it's going to be a big watershed moment.
That's a very interesting point, Jack. Thanks for the call. Let me get Bernadette from Roxborough to join us. Hi, Bernadette. Go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Good morning.
Good morning.
I just came back from Cuba, and you know, we were with a group from Rhodes Scholars, and just to say, I was amazed at the beautiful bus that picked us up, the gorgeous hotels we stayed in, the great agriculture improvement that's going on in that country. But my main point is, you know, I've also been to Haiti, and I have to say, America's been involved in Haiti for over 100 years, yet they've had nothing but corrupt governments. They have over 1,000 NGOs, none of which really work together because there's no wonderful government that takes care of them. The roads out of Port-au-Prince immediately turn into rock and dirt. The Caribbean is a mess. There's just nothing that looks good about Haiti. Cuba, beautiful roads, wonderful people, resilience. The truth is that there's a part of them that says that they're afraid that if the embargo, you know, ends, that's one comment, is they'll just get those Americans that are only into rum and rumba. And so far, those of us that go, of course, tend to be seniors that have the money to be there. But the truth is that they're aware of the changes that are needed. But believe me, they have survived so beautifully and powerfully that that God will work this out in a time. And
right.
I want to also say
well,
that
you know, Bernadette, let me just stop you there. Only because
Greta Fairness.
Oh, I'm only jumping in here only because you said some very interesting things comparing these two countries. And Michael Reed, I want to toss that back to you. Is that a fair comparison, looking at Haiti, looking at Cuba, and saying perhaps Cuba has done a better job and perhaps the U.S. should stay out?
I'm afraid I don't think it is. I mean, because if you go back to 1959, before the revolution, Cuba was a much more developed country than Haiti was then. It's true that Fidel Castro invested hugely in education and health. He could do that because he got a lot of aid, firstly from the Soviet Union, and then well, more recently from Venezuela. But if you look at Cuba now, I mean, you know, Cuba was one of the four or five most advanced countries in Latin America in 1959. If you compare it with, you know, today, with, say, Mexico, Costa Rica, Chile, Uruguay, whatever, I'm afraid it's no longer true that, you know, that Cuban health services are the best in the region, not for ordinary Cubans. I mean, it's been interesting listening to the kind of comments about tourism and so on. And you know, Cuba already is a tourist mecca. I mean, I go there, you know, fairly regularly and have done for, you know, 20 years or so. It's been striking how the tourist industry has grown. In the last year or so, one has seen more Americans as a result of President Obama's policies. That's new, but I mean, there are lots of Europeans and Latin American tourists. But there's a kind of bubble around the tourist economy, and the Cuba that ordinary Cubans live in is a much sadder place, you know, and that's why so many Cubans have wanted to leave anybody with any initiative. It's the only country in the Americas whose population is actually falling, you know. So, yes, Cuba is not as bad as Haiti, but, you know, Haiti has its own problems and its own very sad and difficult history. And, you know, I don't think it's meaningful, really, I'm afraid, to compare them in that way.
We only have a couple of minutes before we have to say goodbye. Peter, let me go back to you because we're talking about, you know, an island nation that we share with Guantanamo Bay. I mean, I realize that's probably a whole, well, there definitely isn't a whole hour there, but how should we factor into the fact that we have a military, a prison system on the same island as Cuba?
Wow, that is a
Marty,
that
sorry
is,
to save that for
is
the
a
end.
Whole hour long discussion.
It is, but
there are examples in other places in the world in which other countries rent space bases You know, the British with Hong Kong, the Portuguese with Macau. I mean, there are a number of other, you know, examples of places in which there are bits of one country that are used by another. And I'm not at all saying that this is the right thing. I'm just saying right. that there are examples, and that, you know, we could talk for a long time about whether it's right and whether it's right for this thing to be a U.S. military base and have had such a prominent role before. But you know, I think in but let's leave that for another time. Could I just mention one other thing that we haven't talked about?
Yeah, and you have a minute for that, Peter. Go ahead.
Which is, there's a diplomatic deadline here that's going to be really interesting. I mean, next year, there is a Summit of the Americas that happens with all the presidents of this hemisphere, from the Northern Hemisphere and from the Southern Hemisphere. They all get together once every 4 years. This is coming up now, next year, and the Latin American presidents have told the United States that the last one that we had in 2012 is going to be the last one that we do without Cuba. So the Americans are going to have to make this big decision about whether they want to come and somehow recognize Cuba, or they are going to not participate. And I think that's just an interesting, in addition to everything else, it's an interesting diplomatic deadline that America is looking at.
Well, it's been an interesting discussion. Peter Schechter, thank you very much for joining us today on Radio Times.
Thank you very much for having me.
You're welcome. And Michael Reed, thank you for joining us as well.
Thank you very much. It's been a pleasure.
Pleasure for us. Michael Reed joining us from Lima, Peru. He writes the Bello column on Latin America for The Economist, and he's the newspaper's writer-at-large for the region. He has a book coming out this year called Brazil, The Troubled Rise of a Global Power. Peter Schechter, director of the Atlantic Council's Adrian Arsht Latin America Center, and the Atlantic Council just released a survey on U.S.-Americans relations, understanding, desires with Cuba. Again, go to whyy.org/radiotimes and check out the photos by Marvin Grima. You can also leave a comment on our homepage as well about our discussion today. I'm Marty Moscowain. Thank you so much for joining us in this first hour of Radio Times, and do stay with us. We'll be right back.